This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah. Even though, yes, I should try to be less niche, for me, this is just for other improvisers. Mm-hmm. And people who are like graduating theater school who are like, okay, well, now I have a theater degree.
Yeah.
And you're like, what do I do now? And you're like, okay, here's 4,000 possible things.
Yeah.
And not 4,000. I think you guys would be episode 178. But
it's not,
that's
just
a lot of
trying
options.
Out for SNL.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what
I mean? In fact, like, yes. I've talked about that so many times. Yes, where it's like, that's my concern. Is that everyone thinks that it's like, I finish an improv class and now I'm in SNL.
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, well, there's about 27 more workshops we need to go through with you before you're prepared for that.
Right.
Like, yeah.
And there's lots of...
And number 27 is a sleep training time.
Even that, the practical implications of improv are so much more than just like being famous, I feel like, right? Like there are interpersonal benefits, there's professional benefits, there's all kinds of just delicious gifts that you get from improv outside of...
Yeah.
Fame and fortune.
Yeah. Also, something that I've recently hit upon personally, like, is that for me, improv, and it's just because this is my circle of the world, right? Everyone isn't found it yet, but I need them to, because it's almost, in my mind, replaced religion. Like, because churches have lost a lot of, you know, cred.
Yeah.
They're not being the cool dudes they need to be to be like, guess what? God loves us.
That's
we are awesome. And you're like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But in improv schools, I mean, especially now as we are really trying our best to be as open and cool to people and like giving people a safe space.
Right.
And the whole essence, like the basic, most basic, all the most dance central thing is yes and.
Right. Yeah.
And that in and of itself is like a philosophy call
of
your life.
It's a spiritual component, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like when I, my very first improv class, I went in and the guy was talking about essentially mindfulness, and I had a background in mindfulness, and I was like, what? Like it's the same thing. And of course it is, because it's about accepting the present moment, what's happening in the present moment, and adding on to that, contributing to that.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's beautiful. It's about connecting with people, finding the liminal space in between our ideas, and living in that space without any contrivance. I think that's a gorgeous, sumptuous idea that can ground us physically, mentally, and heart, body, mind in a way that that other art forms, I think, do as well.
Yeah.
But there's something special
about
improv.
I feel like there's so much more of an inner work, even for like theater. I feel like as theater artists, you have to do so much inner work. But there's even more inner work that has to go into improv to just be okay with whatever comes out of your mouth, because you don't have a script. You know, it's like, you got to be okay with your body as an actor. You got to be okay with your instrument, your voice. You got to be confident, and you have to be confident with whatever words come out of your mouth.
You have to be able to like say yes to say yes to someone else. You have to be able to say yes to yourself. Like, I accept the self wholly and abundantly, and I'm willing to share that with someone else. And only when I'm in that space can I actually say yes to someone else, because otherwise it's this artificial, I'm saying yes, but I'm wearing a mask.
Right.
I don't know.
Lately,
a little esoteric. I get a little esoteric.
Lately, I've been saying to students that improv is yoga for the inner critic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, this, it's very Bay Area. Like, you know, but it's very, whenever I say it, people are like,
yeah.
You know? It's like so deep. It really is, because it's a practice. And no matter where in the art form you are, if you're like, a, you know, 30 years in or whatever, you're still practicing this inner stuff.
Yeah, you know? it's definitely like what people say about meditation, where it's like it's not about doing it once and you're like, okay, guess what, I'm one.
Right.
But it's like it's a regular practice.
Right.
You have to do it every day to get it going.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's gonna be some days, you know, you're off balance. It's just you can't do tree pose that day. You know, you're off balance.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're a horrible yoga person. Just means you're off balance that day. You
right.
You need to work on that.
It's like it's one of those things where if you ever like mastered it, would you really want to keep doing it? I don't know. I mean, although I see people that perform and I'm like, oh, they've mastered it. Yeah.
Well, the beauty for them, I think once, well, number one, I don't think anyone personally ever thinks they mastered
it. Absolutely.
Even if we think they do.
Yeah.
And then the beauty of that is that there are so many variables. The beauty of improv is you can master the technique all you want, but it's not like you're a violinist, for instance.
Right.
You have a limited amount of strings and ability to change, make noise, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas it's because you're not also taking the violin and like putting it next to something else and making it affect, because my instrument is just me and I can make it great. I can be the best ever, but then I have to pair it with other things.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are good or bad or, and by good or bad, I mean like they sound cacophonous or they sound melodic with the vibe that you're putting out. And that is the joy. In fact, one of the things I say with people a lot is, it's easy, I think, to find the joy when you are performing. How are you going to make sure the audience feels your joy?
Yeah.
Like, the experience of a performance for the performers is always awesome.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, always.
Always.
State your parentheses-ish. You know? But for the people watching, how do you also bring it in for them? And it's, you know, not always the old adage of, well, you ask them for a suggestion and that's how they feel together with you. It's like, great.
And like, as a
performer, what about,
how do you make that a repeatable experience? Like, from the like marketing and business of improv.
Right.
If this is your business, right, and you want to be a successful working improviser and a brand, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you make this a repeatable experience to like whoever you're in front of and whoever you play with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard because that is a thing that's in our world now, the idea of this brand and being a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like improv is almost the opposite of that.
Right.
Like, and not just in an actory way where it's like, hey, I can play whatever character I want, but it's like, you, even what we were talking about before, you're ebbing and flowing, you're learning, you're changing.
Mm-hmm.
And even this idea of mastery is like, great, well, she can just go to a different city and find out they're doing it different. Like, I find out things. I've even talked to international improvisers where I'm like, wait, you guys are doing what? Or alternately, I just recently talked to a guy who was literally, the first time he ever found improv exercises online was a teacher in Austin who made videos. And I was like, are you kidding me? You're in Norway and you're telling me the first time you were like, how do I do this? Let's check the internet.
Yeah.
You saw someone I know personally. Like, that is insane.
You're so like, connected. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're so
but
connected.
Yet there are ways that people's brains are framing stuff in a different way. So even when you get to the point of like, how does this brand work?
Right.
You could just be like, another person moves into town and you're like, suddenly it feels different because the vibe, the mix, the like, these spices are working together differently now. It's the beauty and the curse of improv, really.
Right.
Sure.
But the mix, I think, is always the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that you had a background in mindfulness before you started improv. Tell me about that. What does that mean?
What does that mean? It means, there's a period in life where you're like, oh, wow, here's a baseline that's lower than maybe other, what you feel like. I mean, you shouldn't compare yourself to other people, but...
but we all do.
But it's lower than what I would like my baseline to be, where I'm uncomfortable and in dark places for a little bit longer than I should be. I need to do some self-work. What does that look like? How do I... heal myself, essentially. And so I was introduced to a man, Nestor Perez, and he's a meditation meditation expert and like a holistic practitioner, and he had these like private sliding pay scale meditation sessions for small groups. We had to like know someone that knew him to get into it.
Real weird.
Yeah.
Masonry.
Yeah.
Something about exclusivity. Tell me I can't go. I'm into it.
And we had this interesting, and so he would lead in these discussions, and there was an interesting go around a topic. It was around Christmas time, so the sort of topic for that guided meditation was something around like what do you want to let go of for the past year, what do you want to get into. And I had this thing with like, oh, I have walls with people, I keep people compartmentalized, and I control how much interaction and interpersonal space I'll allow them. And there was this moment where he looked into my eyes and basically saw my soul and was like, oh yeah, you know, usually that's a problem with worthiness. We sometimes struggle with feeling worthy when there's a history of some type of abuse or whatever. And I was like, I was just getting over sort of an abusive situation I'd been in for a long time. And then we did this meditation. Just a regular meditation, but much longer than you would do in a beginning session. It was like 20, 30 minutes. My first like guided meditation was like 30 minutes.
Deep dive.
In the space of that meditation, I had this feeling of being huge, real big. Like it felt like my body was just gigantic. Like if I moved my hand, I would knock over the person next to me. It was really weird. And I was like, oh, my brain is not clever. Like that's such an obvious metaphor for like I was feeling small before coming in here, and now I feel really big.
Wow. Oh, you're judging your meditation.
I will judge everything I can. Yeah. So then I realized that meditating made me hallucinate in a really beautiful way without drugs. And I was like, oh, I'm super into this experience.
Much more affordable,
no hangover. It's like positive stuff without the, I don't know, without
well,
the
once
banana.
You got a guy, I mean, this guy.
Yeah, he was fabulous. Yeah. So I started meeting with him super regularly. And then I did a Vipassana in Marin, a week silent retreat thing, which I'm an introvert, so I enjoy not speaking for long periods of time.
Oh, man.
So it sounded like it would be amazing, but the first 2 days were utter and complete hell for me. I was like, I actually do need to talk to people sometimes.
Like, I feel like you need those, in anything, you need those first 2 days of like breakdown.
Yes.
Before you can like open up.
Before you can break through. Yeah. You got to break it down and then heal it. And it was just like that. It was like 2 days of like, oh, I'm going completely insane. And then the third day, I'm outside of it. And I'm able to see what the broken pieces were.
Wow.
And then choose how to rearrange them in this way that's really beautiful and healing. So I identify as a Buddhist, but I don't do it very often because I feel like a white Buddhist in San Francisco is such a cliche. So... but also, you know, it's the truth.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear you. Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's and so getting funny. Into improv, it was like all of these ideas and concepts were not original ideas and concepts in that way. However, like the stuff that you do, mindfulness and improv to me, they're the same freaking thing. It's like completely the same thing.
Yeah.
You get to make choices in improv. Just like in mindfulness, you get to learn that you get to make choices about what you choose to focus on, what thoughts you're going to be obsessive about, or how to let them go.
And for me, like that aspect of mindfulness, for me, that had so much to do with what it meant to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I created our company, Leela, I wanted it to be an artistic haven and not just like, this is how you do improv. You know, I wanted it to be like, let's expose our students to a whole bunch of methodologies, a whole bunch of ways to paint the improv picture, and then let them choose, you know, like let them choose what their artistic voice is. So often in our classes, I think we do more debriefing than most improv training centers, where we'll just be like, what'd you notice?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what'd you notice? What'd you like? You know?
Oh, yeah.
What's your,
I do that all the time.
What's your artistic taste? Rather than, like, this is how you do it at the Leela Training Center. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, we, you know, it's like, here, we exposed you to this artistic tool, this way to paint your improv paintbrush.
Yeah.
Did you like it? Did you enjoy it? What was challenging? What was fun? You know, so you can create your own artistic taste and what you like, you know?
It's funny you mentioned the debrief, because I actually personally use it for my own, like, in the business way.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking about how you have to look at improv in the spiritual way, which is
right.
good. And then there's also the business that you're trying to accomplish. And when I teach workshops, I always ask takeaways at the end. I want to make sure that I'm communicating properly and that everyone's getting what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then also so that, like, they get it again.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, oh, yeah, okay. That, I see how it's connected now. And I feel like that always helps. It helps them. It helps me.
Totally.
And then later I can, you know, like, if they don't get one thing that I really need, I write down, you know, I gotta make sure to focus on this next time, you know.
Because like a lot of improv, beginning improv students, they want to know if they've done it right. And I feel like that, I feel like I have to do so much stripping of that. I'm like, this is your experience. There is no right. You know what I mean? There's like, there's your experience, whether you liked it or not. You know what I mean?
Well,
what it gave you, what tool did it give you as an improv artist, you know?
Yeah.
There is no right or wrong, you know?
You know, I posit, though, that when you're taking improv classes, it's almost similar to the experience of the silent retreat you had, which is that the beginning of it is a lot of breakdown.
Yeah. Breakdown, learning about what you don't know, and then also learning about... This is longer in the process, but like what you think you know that you actually don't know, right? Like in improv, like I had immediate opinions around myself and other people's work when I didn't know a single thing about improv. And it took a few years before I found out, like, oh, I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah,
you know?
And you're giving them a lot of tools. So every tool that you give them, they're like, oh, this is how you, this is the right way to do it.
Right.
This is wrong.
Just
this
one
is right.
Thing.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very black and white. And I feel like in our program, we have a thing called the PIE program. It stands for Performing Improv Ensembles. So after they've completed level 4, they can audition for it. And it's still like a training. It's still like a performance improv training. And you're in a group. You're cast in a group. But a lot of folks in that group, I feel like that's like, for me, that's the hardest stage to work with. I don't know if it is for you, because they have all these rules in their head.
Yeah.
They've taken a ton of classes. They have all these rules in their head of like what's right, wrong. And then... they're like, and then you're asking them to give over to an artistic process and a concept of a director. And they're like, wait a second, but what about the who, what, where? And we're like, we don't have to do that. You know? That's just a tool. We could do a show like that. You know? What about, like, I did a concept show where they all played personified objects. They're like, but we should play people, right? I'm like, well, you can play personified objects. Like,
yeah.
There's no rule in improv that you have to play people, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just like they get really in their heads in that stage a lot of like wanting to do good improv.
Well,
you
it's
know?
Like when you're a child, it's okay, like when you're a child, right? You have no, barely any object permanence and no real concept of like time.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's like we're going on this trip in 3 months. 3 months! That'll never happen. Three months is so far away.
Yeah.
Once you get in your 40s and like 3 months is like half a day, right?
So
3 months, that's tomorrow.
So like you give a new group an idea of a concept and they feel like this is what... Now we'll be doing this, and
forever.
unless we do something about this now, this will be all that we ever do in improv. You know what I mean? Because it's like toddler brain,
true.
Kind of. You know,
so
that sounds really infantilizing, though.
I
don't mean it in that way, but I mean.
I think it's just a stage of development.
Yep.
It's a stage of development
you know,
as an improviser.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be honest.
Yeah.
I am going to jump into a theory of life that I have that my audience has heard 1,000 times. Sorry, everybody. Doing it again.
It's that time.
Get ready. I was like, I bet you they were like, oh god, she's gonna bring it up. As soon as you were like, stage of life, I was like. So I have this theory that we become different people every 18 years.
Oh yeah.
Ooh.
That we are like literally in the same journey from infant to 18 year old every single time. So that when you meet a 19 year old, the reason why they can't do anything is they're a baby.
They're a baby again.
Right?
Yeah.
They're a baby. But it's not because they're
again.
A real baby, of course, you know, but they've been let into this new part of the world. It's like they were in a room with the door closed and then they were like, okay, we've now opened the door. Head on out.
Yeah.
Go out there. Yeah. And you're like, wait, it's just a barren wasteland and people are mean. Yep. Do your thing now. What's my thing? We don't know. Figure that out, you know? Yeah. And so then they're trying to figure stuff out.
Right.
And it's almost like we still go through similar things. So we think about childhood and everyone has a like specific expectations of children and specific expectations of preteens and teens. And what are you going to, when they get to graduating, they got to make a decision about their lives, right? But no one's ever swung by you at 36 and said, like, have you made a decision about your life? But you need to, because you're going to change whether you plan it or you don't plan it. Right in that general region, late 30s, you've achieved what is known as, in my mind, the second cycle of your life. So then you've done it again. You were born as an adult and they were like, okay, figure this out. And then you failed a ton and figured it out. You didn't know how to interact with other human beings or get a job or pay bills or do anything you have to do.
Right.
But then when you get to 36, it kind of gets to the point again where people get a little like, okay, well, what's that? What am I doing now? Am I just going to keep doing the same thing? But you're different. You're not 25-year-old you. You're not 30-year-old you. There's something. You need to do something else. I think, personally, I find this is when people do a lot of, like, crises.
Midlife
they,
crises.
Like, they, like, divorce their spouses. They, like, move to a different city and don't talk to anyone they've met before. Like, they make big changes because they just need to forget.
Restart.
Do a new thing. And even if you don't, even if you're in the same place, something will change. And then
that makes sense.
Later, that's why I think there's, and I'm in my early 40s, and so I've talked to a lot of people in their early 40s about, like, oh man, I kind of don't, I'm figuring it out. I don't know what's happening. So I'm 41, which in my theory then
makes
me 40.
5. I just turned 40 this year,
Right?
So I'm right there with
so
you.
So it's like, I'm kind of like, I'm going to be a thing. And it's probably mom, I think, right now is the major new thing that I'm doing. Because I didn't expect that was going to happen. You know, I had a baby at 39. Who's expecting to have a baby at 39? Not this girl. No.
I mean, I started improv in my late 30s, essentially.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we go through a point where we do it. And that's why when we deal with a lot of 20-somethings who are mostly who's taking improv classes. Believe me, I love the older people because even, like, when you're talking about the thing about your students are like, oh, what do you mean I can be like a tree or I can be like a squirrel? I had a woman in my class one time that was in her 70s, and she was always the one that made every scene exciting. She just became everything. She would be a child. She would be a rock. She would be a flower. She would be like an undersea creature. Like, she brought the magic to all of it because she was into it.
And also, at that late stage in life, you're starting to get back into... I feel like what we're continually learning is how to connect with the child that had all of the, didn't have the judgments that were put upon them, you know, that not yet when you're a child, you're like this pure play thing before you have your inner critic developed and all that stuff.
I know, my child's 3 right now and I'm like, does she have an inner critic yet? I don't know.
And you get... I love getting new students that are in their 60s and their 70s because they're closer to that. They're closer to like, oh yeah, I've been doing all these weird judgments all my life and I'm going to...
Fuck it. Yeah.
I'm painting with a really broad
brush. No, I think older people have a more fuck it attitude. It's just like, I don't care anymore.
For
you know?
Real.
Yeah.
And fabulous. There was a... I don't want to name her. But I had a student that was in her... she was close to 70 and she was a librarian and then she was also a poet and she's like... from Berkeley.
Right.
And she was so exciting in every scene that she did. She was just super exciting because she made bold choices. They were smart choices.
Yeah.
They were without fear. And I don't mean bold like piratey, jerky bold, but like just choices without judgment.
An adult person who left their house.
Bold. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, as you get older, it gets harder to be like, I will leave this nice warm alcove of my own home and talk to other humans. So when you meet people in their 60s and 70s who are like, yeah, I'll take a class, That's the joy.
Yeah.
That's the joy of life right there, for real.
Yeah.
In fact, joy, isn't that what the word Lila means?
Play.
Yes. Play.
Which is joyful.
The play, the play of life, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, like, it's interesting. I was reading a book called Free Play. Have you read this book by Stephen Nachmanovich?
No.
And it's kind of like a theoretical dissection. I think he's a professor or something. Theoretical dissection of improvisation in like lots of artistic mediums and the very yeah, like music, dance, you know, poetry, everything, right? In the very first paragraph of the book, he talks about Lila and this word that means play in Sanskrit, but it's divine, right? It's like spiritual connection. It's, you know, it's like that's what improv is for me, you know. And when I was figuring out what to call our company, I was like, I really want it to be a woman's name because I dealt with a lot of like sexism growing up in improv in the 90s. And so like I just was like, I really want to bring a feminine energy to this art form. And I'm in San Francisco, it's very feminine energy. It's like, I really want a word that encapsulates what improv means to me. And I was like, Lila is a woman's name, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so we just called it Lila. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So so Stephen started with meditation and then got into improv. What did you start with to get before you got into improv? Or you just known about improv from the gate?
So I was a theater kid. I love theater. I also love team sports. So when I was like 8, 9, 10, I became a big, huge like TV couch potato. My parents were like really concerned about me because I would just like sit this close to the TV, you know? And like they were like, oh God, Jill, like she's just watching TV. Like that's all she's doing, you know? So they got me involved in sports because I thought it was good for me. And then they got me involved in theater, you know, kind of simultaneously.
Yeah.
And I liked them both, you know? And so I think for me, that was kind of the hybrid, you know, like, when you're taking acting classes as a kid, it's all theater games, you know what I mean? So I really love the theater games part of it. And then I, you know, did theater in high school. I did all the plays and all that kind of stuff. Got a theater degree in college. But when I was in college, I just stumbled upon this really amazing improv troupe that happened to be at my university. And this woman was a graduate student. The woman who was teaching the improv program was a graduate student. And she had this really great idea of like, we need to increase our membership. Let's just make it a club and a class, you know? And so it like spread like wildfire. And I went to a really huge state school. I went to University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. And so we had people who were like engineer majors, physics students, you know, every major in this class.
It's great.
It was so much fun, you know? It wasn't just the theater geeks, you know?
Yeah.
She was really into Sark. She was from Salem, Massachusetts.
Ooh.
She was a witch. Everybody.
Yay.
Ooh, I love it. I love Salem.
She was a Reiki master. She was just had this intense, fiery energy. I say had, she's still alive. I just have this vision of her in the past. Her name is Heather Roberts. She got married, so it's Heather Roberts Parody. But like she was just this force, you know. We were all just like felt like you were going to like some improv guru, and she'd do these like preaching lectures before improv class about how improv is a lesson for life and how we need to change up our patterns and walk differently to our different paths to our class every day, you know, like just like all these beautiful lessons. She was really into Sark. So Sark,
I'm not familiar with that.
She created those posters like How to Be an Artist. Did you ever see those posters that were really popular in the 90s? They were like all different like rainbow colors. It was like How to Be an Artist, like eat peaches messily or something, like sleep in, you know, like do all these like creative things for your, it's kind of like a combination of self-care and artists.
But what is the word
the woman, Sark? The woman who created these books and posters, her name, she went by Sark, S-A-R-K.
Oh, okay.
So Heather was really into Sark, like she read all her books and did all her journals, and like she would bring that into...
Thought it was maybe another undercover society.
No, maybe. But she actually is from the Bay Area. She lives like in a magic cottage in Berkeley or something, she calls it, and she got the magic...
Heather Roberts?
No, this woman, Sark.
Oh, Sark.
Yeah, Sark. So we would all call, like Heather had this, like, Sark method or something. She, like, hybridized Sark and improv and Reiki and...
So fucking
Wiccan and, like, you know, like, all this stuff. So she was just amazing. She influenced so many of us, you know?
How great that a person working for University of Florida put so much effort into their job.
Student.
Like, it's so...
Yeah.
All you need to do in the world, guys, is do your job.
Yeah.
That's it. If you do it, what they ask you to do,
Right.
People's lives will change. Like, yeah. The fact that she was like, what do I have to do? I have to teach them this. Let me teach them what I think is cool. And it's about
and
that.
And it grew.
Like, yes.
There was a point where there was 150 people in that class.
Whoa.
Because she just would, like, open, like, anybody could come. So we would, like, crowd into this upper lobby of the university, of the theater auditorium, this upper lobby area. And it would just be packed. And people would be sitting on the stairs. And just, like, it was crazy.
Oh, my God.
It was huge. And we would, like, divide into different areas of the auditorium space to have class, and then there would be like senior students would like lead other groups. It just like became this thing, you know?
For how many years did she do that? Because she's a grad student, right? So she's not like there forever.
Yeah, I came in when maybe it was like her second or third year as a when I was a freshman. Yeah, and it was kind of an interesting kind of golden age, too, because, like, all the seniors in the group were super passionate about improv, and there was this, Austin, Texas, so there was this festival that they really wanted to go to that they heard about in Austin, which was the Big Stinkin' Improv Festival, and the year before I came in as a freshman, they had all gone to this festival, and all these teachers from Chicago were there, like Del Close and McNapier and all this long form that they had no idea about, and then they came back and was like, we're moving to Chicago. You know, like a whole bunch of them were like, after we graduate, we're moving to Chicago. You know, and a whole gaggle of them went, and a lot of them are now teaching, performing, doing amazing things in Chicago. So a lot of us who like kind of grew up around that time are doing this full time. So it's really cool. We all like keep in touch with each other. And her motto for improv was like, play from a place of love. You know, she would like put signs up, like play from a place of love. Like, that's the most important thing. Like not going for comedy, like going for love, you know? Yeah. So we all have this like base in like playing from heart and kindness, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, which really influenced like my style of teaching too, you know?
Yeah, and building a community that really needs to be the center.
So my journey, So my journey, like she was such a guru for me. So when like she left, she moved to New York and she was doing some stuff in New York. And she connected with Martin DeMott. Do you know Martin DeMott? He was a teacher out of the Second City in New York.
Okay.
Beautiful, beautiful man. And he also had this like very heart-based approach, you know? When it was my time to graduate, I was talking to her and I was like, I don't know what to do. My friends are moving to Chicago. But she's like, you need to study with Martin. Like he plays from a place of love. Like you have to study with Martin. So she's like, here, I'll get you his number. Cause he was trying to get her to work with him. Cause she's like, the Sark method. He knew this like Sark method that she teaches from. So she got me his phone number. I had like this half an hour phone call with him, and I was just like, I really want to study with you. And I just like fell in love with this man. I'm like, I'm moving to New York, I'm gonna study with you. A week before I moved to New York, he passed away.
Whoa.
And I was just like, what? And apparently he influenced like a bunch of improvisers that I totally respect. Like I'll come up to them, it's like, oh my god, I love your improv. Like who was your teacher? Who was your inspiration? It's like Martin DeMott. And I'm like, fuck. You know, it's like Jonathan Pitts, David Rosowski, Rachel Hamilton, I think Scott Adsit, a whole bunch of improvisers that I just really love. I can tell they just have this like this love. There's this like love to their work. It's very relationship based. It's very kind. I don't know how to. There's like an energy to it, but they all tell me Martin DeMott. I'm like, oh my god! Like Rachel Hamilton's dog is named Marty.
Oh, that's
after
fun.
Martin.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's just so fascinating to me because a lot of people talk about like their one-on-one conversation with Martin, like if they were in class with him or whatever, was like life changing. And I feel like I had this half an hour phone call with him that was life changing, you know. And I was like, at least I had that. You know, because I was wanting to go study with him.
Yeah.
So I moved and I studied
to
with,
New York?
Yeah, I still moved.
Oh, you still did it. Okay, I wondered moved. Like, how did this like big, terrible thing affect your like full speed ahead? But what does that do to you?
Well, also my husband had already gone to New York. Or my now husband, who was my boyfriend at the time.
Okay.
He had moved to New York and I was kind of like, we were like long distance dating, whatever. Mm-hmm. He's 5 years older than me. And I was still kind of on the fence, Chicago, New York, Chicago. And I was like, well, he's in New York. I'll go to New York. And I'm like, and there's Upright Citizens Brigade in New York, which I hear is kind of like.
They're okay.
That was my mind frame. Like, sure. They had just started. Like, Upright Citizens Brigade, this was like 2000, had just started a theater. And I was like, oh, I heard they're just like I.O., but they're in New York. So I'll go there. And so I studied there. And then I was there in the beginning, like, August, July, August 2001, I moved to New York.
Yeah.
What happens September 2001?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a month into New York, 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was studying at UCB, and I had some weird experiences there with some people I was playing with, and I was just like, it feels backstabby here. It feels so competitive. And when 9/11
happened,
it does
seem to be a place that has a lot of competition. Yeah.
It wasn't like the team sport I wanted. You know, it wasn't the play from a place of love I was looking for. You know, with like Martin and Heather, and. I was like on the internet, and I was like, well, I want to do something with my life. I want to do something with improv. I don't want to just be a selfish actor. Not that that was just in my head, not to be selfish or something. You know, since 9/11 happened, I was like, I'm going to do something with my life.
Yeah.
My life is important. And so I was just like, I've heard about like dance therapy and art therapy. I wonder if there's anything like improv in therapy, because it was therapeutic for me. Mm-hmm. And I heard about drama therapy. And there was two schools in the country, one in New York and one in San Francisco. I applied to both. I didn't get into New York. I did the interview process in San Francisco, fell in love with the city, got in, and then I studied drama therapy in San Francisco. So I'm I have a master's in drama therapy, and I got licensed as a marriage and family therapist too, using drama therapy. So that was like this is the path that I feel like maybe I could have had. Oh, this is the other funny story about Martin DeMott. I heard I had in my head that he had a PhD in psychology. I don't know where that came from. Like I read it or somebody told me that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do drama therapy. It's like, well, if I can't have Martin, maybe I can like re-engineer the Martin experience, you know? So I was like, I'm gonna study psychology and improv, you know, because that's what he did, you know? And Mick Napier was a student of Martin Mott, a very avid student of his who I love.
Oh man, you really lost out.
And then like, yeah. And then like, so then I went through the whole program, I got licensed, all this stuff. After I got licensed, I was just kind of curious, like, I'd love to do some research on Martin DeMott. Just like, I'm just curious about him, because I've been hearing his name. And apparently he got an honorary PhD in psychology.
Because
he was
such a
For real, like an amazing, I'll take an honorary.
He got an honorary degree. And I was like, I fucking got all these student loans. Like, I got licensed, all these hours of study.
Don't
How dare
back,
you? Now you're a master. You played a trick.
Just don't pay him back, and then you can call it honorary.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was like, yeah, that was my path.
Oh man.
Sorry, that was really long.
No, yeah. No, I'm.
It was a great story.
No, it's funny because I feel like the moment when you brought Martin back was like, I did it because of him, but it was like the other part of your story where it was like when 9/11 happened, you felt like you needed to do something was real. Like that was across the board, full countrywide. Mm-hmm. People were like, you know what? Maybe I don't need to be an asshole.
Right.
I need to just figure out how to help the world.
Yeah,
right? So
totally.
That's a good effort. I'm glad that this man inspired you from the grave to get a master's in drama therapy.
Yeah.
But I feel like your effort, your like need to find a way to turn what you love to do into a way to help the world. I mean, and what a great way to do it.
I also feel like Steve and I had talked about this a lot. Like I've struggled with my inner critic a long time, you know, and I've always found that like I directed a project in an improv project in college, and I got so many kudos from my teachers because when I was acting, I had this like perfectionist brain. I was like verging on anorexia constantly. I would beat myself up. I just like perfectionist. But when I was directing or teaching, I felt like I could serve in a very like healthy way than just like picking on myself as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and it just, I felt like I could use all my like, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I feel like I think very thoroughly about this art form, you know what I mean? And I was able to do that better in service of others than for myself.
You know, they say sometimes the best way to help yourself is to help others.
Yes,
yes, absolutely.
So, you know, if
it was much more
if you're in a point where you, I mean, there's definitely points where you want to focus on yourself. You got to give yourself the attention, you know.
Yeah.
And there's ups and downs to this current culture of self-care where it's like, all right, occasionally you
can talk about
self-care.
That in San Francisco.
Occasionally,
you want to talk about San Francisco.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Sorry. self-care just becomes an excuse for self-obsessive.
And it also like is like, okay, yeah, but you have to like, you know, before you can slough off the dead skin, you need to have the life of dead skin. Like you have to develop and get the calluses and do things before you can be like, now I need to calm down. Are you amped? Like if you're not, then you don't have anywhere to go. But
I always say
that's just the cycle. In my mind, everything's a cycle, and my 18-year theory has helped me to like process my own life. But also, at any point when I'm feeling low, I'm like, there is an upswing. I don't know where it is. It's not nearby, it's like a growth but it's happening.
Yeah.
Because I'm old enough now that I've had bad and good times, so I'm like, well, just wait. Yeah. And be distracted by something else. And that's when the self-care comes in. When you're like, I can't no more.
Right.
Yeah. Like, then you self-care. But sometimes to give to other people is the most self-care you could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
I love teaching.
Yeah.
And people even ask me now, like, they'll be like, oh, do you want to perform? And I'm like, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Because for me, it's not as creative. Like, I can perform, but I'm just caught up in my own nerves and worried about this. And am I doing that? Who cares? I don't want that. No.
Yeah.
I would rather help create a full picture thing and do this. And also, you know, not everybody's got the, like, stick-to-itiveness to get a show done. So, like, if you do, be that person.
Yeah.
Because in a theater community, there's probably 10 people that can accomplish making it to finish. And then there's the people who help.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, I can do my one job, most people say.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have the ability to do and help and keep it together, I think you should use that in your own way and use it for good.
Yeah.
So when did you guys connect? You're both run Leela together, is that correct?
Well, Stephen is now the associate artistic director.
Yeah.
I am the artistic director. Nice. Remember before show you were like, I am the artist. I almost got usurped on stage.
I tried to stage a coup. She actually runs the school with her husband, Joe.
Chris.
Chris is his
name. Joe, yes.
You're Joe.
Who he collaborates with a lot, too, so it's kind of,
I collaborate with them.
He is the triangulated person.
Yeah.
the three of you started together, or did you guys start and
they
then you
started.
Joined
I came
as
in, I came in as a student, not 2012, 2013. I'm kind of a newborn in improv in my own way. But I started teaching really quickly afterwards. I did have a background in scripted theater and musical theater and vocal performance. So it wasn't like a stage was a daunting experience, but improv certainly could be. And Joe was actually at the first drop-in class that I took. I was actually inspired to take improv after seeing a Hideout Theater show. The year previous to that, because I'm Capricorn that procrastinates. So this festival is like super special for me personally, for us both. But
I grew up in Texas. I grew up in Plano, so it's really fun to be back.
Great!
I used to live in San Antonio before moving.
Oh, so you guys aren't overwhelmed by the heat? You're okay.
Well, kind of. I like heat, I am bummed out by the constant fog, and say I'm one of three people that doesn't love the fact that San Francisco's foggy all the time that lives there. And my body doesn't remember this heat.
I know,
as soon as we stepped off the plane, I was just like, that's what that's like. Oh, that's weird, you know.
But
like,
it is weird.
Well,
that's why just the fact that you had experienced it before was like, oh, great, good for you. Because I feel like people who come in. And then they're like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's a physical presence here.
Yeah.
You know how in New York you can kind of feel your heart flutter that's the physical presence there?
Yeah.
Here, it's just weight of heat on your body. Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay. That's why people went during South by Southwest, which is in March, which the rest of the world is just covered in snow and terribleness. Like, here it is warm already.
Yeah.
That's when it starts. That's when spring starts.
Yeah.
So it gets normal people warm.
Yeah. Right.
And then people come here and they're like, this is amazing. I'm going to move here. And the percentage of people that live in Austin always increases after March every time.
Oh, my God.
And we're like, listen, this, don't get convinced. This is the siren song. Don't, this is 1 month. And we hate this month because you're here. So yeah. Don't. No, no.
Like, my favorite memories of this part of Texas are the winters. The winters are gorgeous. Like, for me, we're gorgeous. It was like 70 degrees day and night. Yeah. I don't have to wear a jacket at night. I can be in my shorts at night. Like, that's sexy for me.
It was like 4 days that are 40, and you're like, ooh, it's nippy.
Ooh,
la,
la, la. I don't know what to
do. Have a hot chocolate, and then it's over. And it's
one light freeze that nobody can drive anywhere down here because
everyone's
like,
stuck, schools are closed. Like, for what? For what? Snow, guys. Oh. It's snow out there.
Yeah.
Air quotes. Man. Good. I'm glad you'd been here before.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. You know, also, you mentioned that you were new to improv, too, but...
Relatively, yeah.
I really feel like, I mean... It's new to the world. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, like, it's only...
It's a rebirthing almost. Yeah.
Well, there's, like, the beginnings of it aren't even that long ago. Yeah. You know? And I know that it's born of ancient whatever. Right. Like, you know, when I start doing my theater history, it's like, well, Commedia dell'arte is pretty much improv.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we didn't have rules and groups and the way we do now.
There's like
But then not only that, there's like a business model and a community.
That's true.
Even now, at this very moment, as people who run a business that is improv, I have read articles, the recent articles about like UCB's business issues and what's going on with that.
Yeah.
And I feel like we talk about it a lot because it's like we need, they're right now, they're gold standard in a certain way, based on like what happens to you if you take classes there, or what used to happen, I guess. And it's not so gold standard anymore. Right. And I feel like even in its financial issues, we need to learn from the financial issues.
Yeah.
It's like, what did they spend money on that we shouldn't be spending money on?
Right.
Or like, what did they do? Because the like argument always is make sure people get paid and all that kind of stuff.
It's hard to make sure people get paid.
100%. There's not
a
lot of money coming in or
out. Like these, like, it's not growing off trees, you know?
Yeah.
When people complain about it, I just want to be like, hey, look at the numbers. Like, come on. Where do you expect me to bring this money from? Like, especially in San Francisco. And I'm guessing New York, too. Like, space is ridiculous.
Yes. I believe the rents were what killed them.
If we're breaking even, you know, that's what we shoot for.
Our rents are...
Is breaking even.
Yeah.
You know, especially with shows. With... And I think most of the business models in improv theater is like you make your money off the training, right?
Yeah.
You make your money off the training. And then that's what people are complaining about, right? Oh, I have to go through all these levels. It's like Scientology, right? And paying all this money, you know, just to get on stage. And then I don't get paid on stage. And, you know, it's like, it's an interesting conundrum, you know, because it's like, yes, people understand the value of classes, you know, and they will pay money for it. But then there's a certain point where they're like, oh, do I have to take classes for the rest of my life? Like,
well, I worry, too, that there's a wheat and a chaff to the improv world and the larger improv world that I'm realizing is there. I realize that it's almost like what you mentioned earlier about how you felt when you were at UCB. There's a competitive group,
totally
a group that's trying to be famous, that's trying to get a TV show.
Right.
They want to be Raymond when everybody loves Raymond.
Right.
They want to be that guy who gets a show, who does a thing. Great. But then there's people who are like, you know what, though? This art form is kind of a nice thing. I like doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's different groups. And that's why I think it's hard in cities where there maybe isn't a group that's like, this is going to train you to get to LA. And this one's going to, if you'd like to take classes for 27 years, this is where you'd like to come hang out.
Yeah. And I think especially with your podcast of like having people really figure that out, for me, like that I wasn't a bad person, that I didn't feel the cultural fit at UCB. I learned a hell of a lot there. You know, I still use my UCB tools, you know, of like game and premise and pattern and all that kind of stuff. And it's still in me. And I'm glad I had that training. But it wasn't a cultural fit for me, you know?
Yeah.
And I think students need to ask, like, they need to think about that as they, I think that's me, as they train, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't feel like a good fit. Like, you don't have to.
There is no one-size-fits-all creative life at all.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, and I think you're right. That is kind of what I would like to communicate to the audience always, because even like like starting later in your life, or deciding to do it for the love of improv and not about trying to be a famous person or whatever. But, like, there's different ways to go about it, and we judge. Even just then, I realized I judged the people that were being competitive. Right. When I said wheat from the chaff, that phrase has judgment in it, in that I think that people who are going for the art are somehow better. And they're not.
Right.
It's just a different vibe. Yeah. It's like people who are good at sales versus people who are good at, you know, sort of it's a like, longer term quieter situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Accounting, I guess.
And for me, like, when I was in San Francisco, like, and after I finished my drama therapy degree, I was like, I want to start this improv theater. And San Francisco felt like the best place for me because San Francisco was this, like, artistic haven. It's like, it's art for art's sake. Like, nobody's chasing SNL in San Francisco. You know, it's like we're chasing, like, artistic whatever, experimentation and risk-taking, and let's just try shit. And, you know, that was what jived for me.
Yeah.
But, like, this is where I want to have my company. Yeah.
So was it right after the drama therapy, right after you got your master's, you started
my husband and I started it. We're like, let's just do it. You know, let's just teach a class. And we just, like, started, like, putting up posters because back then we didn't have, you know, Facebook and Yelp and all that, you know.
Believe me, I miss posters.
I
used to love posters. Yeah. And now it's like, people are like, why are you printing posters?
Yeah.
I just started. Because I'm 41 and that's what you do.
Yeah, because it was
I make stickers and pins, too. Like, who uses these? I don't know.
I just started, you know, teaching classes around the city, just experimenting, you know, with philosophies and things I learned in drama therapy school, ideas I was playing with in my head, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Was it mostly did you guys pull different teachers from around the city, or was it like just you and your husband just pulling exercises from your past or books or...
From our experience with Heather, the group... at University of Florida was called Theater Strike Force. So we pulled from that. Yeah, we also did social activist theater sketches.
Because San Francisco. Yeah.
Well, that was in Florida.
Oh, what?
That was in Florida.
Because college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Teacher, I don't know.
Yeah.
So we pulled from that, and we pulled from... We pulled from training at UCB, you know?
Yeah.
When I was in New York, I studied with Armando Diaz. I really liked him.
Yeah. So you just put it together, created a syllabus, and then just started doing...
I don't even know if it was a syllabus. I think we just taught, like, drop-in classes. You know? It was, like, nothing super formal. It's like, let's just put it out there that we have a class and see who can come. I mean, sometimes we had, like, 3 people show up, and we're like, all right. You know?
So when did that start? What year was that?
2003.
2003, you started that. And now, how many classes do you have going? What's the size of the...
It really exploded.
There's levels 1 through 7, and now we have a musical improv program as well. And there's we just added a 4th level to that. We have the performing improv ensemble program. We do shows Fridays and Saturdays at the Exit Theater. And probably concurrently during the week, I would say, we do a drop-in class on Monday and Thursday night, and then we do a levels class on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and sometimes Thursdays. So there's a lot of classes.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a space for the classes?
So the San Francisco Chronicle building.
Home of the Zodiac Killer letters. Sorry, that's just a me thing.
I
frequently have that realization dawn on me because the Zodiac, that book was like, I read that book like 3 times when I was a teenager because I'm creepy. Because I liked, it was a genuinely terrifying book.
True little crime would is I like know the that number I would, one thing right now.
Sure, 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 sure.
The psychology
and
psychopaths, it's fun.
That book terrified me. I didn't know that I would actually live in the Bay Area in my future. So I think it was like 2 years ago. I've been in that building for 7 years or whatever. It was like 2 years ago I was in the building and I was like, oh, the letters came here! The letters came here! Like the Zodiac letters came here. I was so excited by that. Anyway, it's total non sequitur tangent there.
That's why the security guards are so weird with
us. It's okay.
Right?
The theater that I spend most of my time at has the weird Mason magic. I like it. We should do a research
study. We should do a research study. How many spaces have weird, like, things like that?
I feel like people try to find that, though. Like, when they're looking, because number one, those things are always, like, super cheap because no one wants, they're like, 47 murders were here.
Let's go there.
Is that, what is it, $250 a month? We'll take it. We'll take it. We'll clean the blood. I've got bleach.
Yeah.
Fine.
But the building itself, it houses several different, like the SF Chronicle is still housed out of there, but it only takes up 10% of probably I would say 10% of the building because
RIP Tabania.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can do a short history of space. Yeah. That's an interesting thing in San Francisco. So when we first, I call it Lila 1.0. So like years like 2003 to 2008, like Chris and I, my husband, were super plucky. We were like in our 20s, you know, we're like, let's just have a theater. Let's do it, you know? And so there was another space down the street from the Chronicle called the Off Market Theaters. And there was this guy, Matt Quinn, who was trying to develop a theater complex, or he did develop a theater complex called the Off Market Theater. So it was like an old office historical building, so it was like cheaper rent, and there were different like little theaters that were carved out, you know? And we took over one of the spaces. It was like a 50 something seat house, and we were just like young and plucky, and we were like, we can fill this, we can do this, we can pay for this, and you know, so like when the 2008 economy collapsed, right, that really hit us hard. So we got out of the space, we had so much debt, we had like, because we were putting everything on credit cards, it was just bad. So we got big people jobs after that, kind of went on a hiatus for like 3 or 4 years. And then in 2010, I was feeling the itch again. And I was like, we were just walking down that street, like going down memory lane. And we saw the Chronicle building and that there was this company called Intersection for the Arts, which is a nonprofit company that just moved into that space. And we're like, what's going on here? You know, like there's like arts here again, like what's happening? So we walked in and Intersection for the Arts just like open arms. We're like, you guys want to rent space here? You want to get involved? Like they were just a company. Their whole mission was to support arts and artists. Arts companies, small arts companies. So they just helped us. We're like, I think we want to start teaching classes again. And how can we do that with you guys? And they really helped us. And so we just like kind of grew incrementally with their help. It was really beautiful. And since then they've moved out of that space and they had their own space and we kind of took over like that position in the building.
Yeah. Do they still function as a nonprofit that helps artists?
Yeah. Yeah, they just moved to a different location. Yeah,
they just moved to a different location.
In that beautiful space, right?
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. It's like it's almost like their model now is kind of like a co-working space, and then they help artists like find grants and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even just being a person you can talk to be like, hey, how do I do this? Great.
They were
that's
incredible.
So wonderful.
They were incredible. They were just like so supportive. Like we couldn't have done this, what we've done without them.
What an angel. Yeah. Just really helped.
Yeah. And the other thing they had was in the basement of the Chronicle, they had this one space that we use as a rehearsal space, and it was massive. Mm-hmm. And we're like, in San Francisco? Like, this space is, like a unicorn. What is this? And so we decided when we came back, we're like, let's freaking teach a drop-in class. Like, let's just see if there's interest in the city. Because I was so bitter and jaded with all the money that we lost, you know? Yeah. And so I was like, let's just see, like, if people even want this improv stuff, you know? So we advertised for a free drop-in class. We had no limit on the cap of people because it was this massive space. And it was ridiculously successful. We had, like, 80 people at a drop-in class.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And then, like, somebody came up to me and was like, you know, Jill, like, this is awesome what you're doing. This is really fun and exciting. But you should. It's a really big value. And I was like, well, what would you pay? I was like, market research, who does, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know, like $10, $15. And then he was like, and yeah, there's way too many people here. And I was like, well, what would you cap it at? He's like, I don't know, like 20. There's our drop-in class now.
Right? Very formalized. Decision-making process, yeah.
But it was awesome.
Yeah, no, I've had that before where I've, and in fact, because I've taught classes and established like rates and stuff like that in my life, I've taken classes before where at the end of the class, after I pay the pittance to take this wonderful class, when we finish, I go, next time you teach this class, you need to triple the cost.
I can't do this. I've had to.
Like, I know. I'm so, like, the information you've given me from beginning to end, this was 2 days. And there's a place that charged me, and it was just so cheap. And I was like, well, I have to sign up for this. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then when I went in, I was like, yeah, you need to not way more.
You just totally changed my life.
And
Like, you taught me so much more than people that I've paid twice as much to. Right. And you need to, you know. It's interesting because people don't realize their value. It's really hard in the arts world to do that, because there is this whole like, yes, sure, it would be great if all the performers were paid. And if that's the case, then, you know, a lot of theaters, there are some business models where it's like, there's two major shows.
Yeah.
They cast those shows for the year.
Right.
And that's who's on stage.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to be in the student shows, great. That's over here.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the side stage. And it's like free shows and get some stage time, and then you can do it.
Yeah.
If you'd like to be paid.
Right.
But the problem is, like, even literally even just the accounting of like 10 or 15 people that you need to pay out at the end of every show is the craziest. Yeah.
So here's our story with like paying performers too, because when we first moved to San Francisco and started this up, Chris and I were like, let's get the best of the best. You know, like, we want to have a big splash in San Francisco when we start this. So we cast a resident company, like, alongside our classes. And with the resident company, we told them we would pay them, we would pay ourselves nothing, and we'd pay them all the profit from our shows. So we had, like, I think, like, five or six people, and their first two shows, they would do monthly shows, their first two shows, they each walked away with, like, $60. Because they were marketing, and they were excited, and all this kind of stuff, you know, and they were hitting it, and they were doing a really good job. Third, fourth show, everybody got lazy, you know, it's like, we're riding on this, right? And they didn't make any money, you know, and all this stuff, and then we paid ourselves nothing, you know, like, me and Chris doing all this producing work. So Chris and I are always like, we need, you know, in order to be sustainable, we do need to, like, pay ourselves something, you know, like, all the credit card debt we've done, gotten over the years, like, you have to as a producer.
Yeah.
As much as you're like, you feel like you need to, like, give to the performers, you do have to give yourself something.
It's hard too, because are you guys running just as a, and we don't have to talk too much, I don't want you to give away all the business. Are you running as an LLC or a nonprofit?
LLC.
Yeah. See, that's LLC. The difference between the two different kinds of businesses. Yeah. I honestly, despite
the fact that
we're actually
thinking
about
changing to a, what is it called, an S corp. We're going down that path.
It's still an LLC, though.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's still a for-profit.
There's different rules around employees and contractors and stuff. Yeah.
In fact, wait, I'm going to write this down. I'm going to give you the name of some people that could help with that. The thing about it is, I don't know that much in the way of the difference between the businesses, but I am always fascinated when I talk to different people and different business models, because, you know, we're artistic people. We didn't get into the arts to be business people. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that apparently we have to.
Yeah.
So, in order to figure out how to charge certain things, like, for instance, we talked earlier about how, like, my husband and your husband work in, like, AV stuff. That seems easy to it to cost a lot of money, because it's like high technology that like I don't understand.
Right.
So if he's got a knowledge that I don't have, which means I got to pay for that knowledge. Yeah. But the problem is, this sort of ethereal community, like, artistic thing is super hard.
Yeah.
And I almost, it makes me think of, like, the meditation world. How did the meditation world get such high clout? Like, how did it become where it's like there are some places, like, there are people who are, like, legitimately could never afford, like, a certain meditation classes.
Right.
What? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
How expensive are they? Very expensive.
Yeah.
But because that's the thing. So part of me wonders if maybe it'll just ebb and flow, like, in the coming years when the arts become the most important thing.
Yeah.
What I believe.
Well, people do complain about improv classes being too expensive. People do complain about that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe.
Doesn't UCB charge like $400 a class now, I think?
Yeah, but I mean, it's like $400 in New York City. What is that? You know what I mean? Like, if you're living in New York City already, you got cash. Like, you're not.
Yeah.
If you're paying rent, I mean, they live in one bedrooms $2,000 a month. Are you kidding me?
In San Francisco, but still, it's like people are paying ridiculous amounts of money just to live.
Yeah.
That it's like all their like spending money is just like, you know what I mean?
Well, you know what though? I mean,
unless they're in certain fields.
There's different ways for people to pay for their stuff. Like, it's like, okay, you don't have money? Great. Then you have time. Because you need to give me X, Y, and Z. You need to do this, you know, work the door, work off that. We had a ton that were just working off their tuition. The entire staff for years was just working off tuition.
Yeah.
And like, I'd just keep it organized. How many hours you putting in versus how much you've done. And when you're done, I'd let you know you're done. Then you can stop working or you can keep working. I don't have money to give you to do the job, but if you'd like it, we're welcome to continue to do it. I don't get a lot of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the weird thing about it is people will do what they want to do, right. And people who want to complain will always complain. Like, you're going to complain about it's $100. If it was $400, you're going to complain. If it's $100, you're going to complain. Yeah. So, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just human people. It's issues when it's going to come. And it's also the idea of this self-care thing to bring back this hot button topic.
Might not want to share this with our San Francisco audience.
No.
They need to hear it.
What I'm saying is, if you're willing to buy, if you're willing to self-care your hands and your feet and your skin and your muscles and your brain, then you should be able to self-care an improv class because it's going to help you in ways that you don't even though it was hot button to us, I'm saying since it is popular right now, they should consider improv in that.
No, and I think that's totally our market. Like, that's totally our demographic.
I mean, people world that we live in right now are staring at screens, isolated. Yes. The number one thing, I had a friend, I have a few friends that do like political, where they like pull stories together and they're like, I posit that this is what's going on in the world based on these things that are happening. Yeah. One of my friends has recently posted a thing about how they think loneliness is what's causing a lot of the trouble.
Absolutely.
That people just feel isolated and it makes them angry and then they're lashing out at other
this
people.
This false veneer of like, oh, we're more connected now than ever is just complete and utter tripe. Like,
and
absolutely.
Improv
can
cure loneliness.
And
I do believe.
Absolutely.
Bring you to talk to other people. It is a safe space.
Yep.
And in places when it's not, it's being called out for not being safe.
Yeah.
No places are not being called out anymore.
Yeah.
It's happening. It is a stronghold of safe space. You need to meet other human beings. Yes.
Right.
Talk to them about anything at all.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite part about level one, class one, is I go, okay, let's do some scenes. And they're like, what, already? And I was like, yeah, we don't know each other. So what we're going to do now is talk.
Yeah.
I was like, how about you two meet in front of us all? Go
ahead.
Where are you from? Okay, talk about that.
Put it on stage.
And then they just chat. And then we're like, guys, that was a scene.
That was a scene,
Like, what? But all I did was tell them how I'm from St. Louis. And I was like, that's what you talk about in scenes.
Such a good,
like,
such a great approach, too, because it's like so much like people when they go into it, think, I have to learn how to play other people and other characters and other like, and now I'm in my head and I'm trying to think about being funny.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always, for beginners, just like, you don't worry about being funny. I want you to be present with your person. Try to connect with them. Just try to connect with them. Show us what that looks like. Yeah. So such an important thing to show that, like, oh, right, we just have this interaction and that's interesting in and of itself for us to witness is two human beings actually interacting with each other. That's interesting. You don't have to have to dress it up. It doesn't have to be anything more than that. The human experience is intrinsically interesting. You are intrinsically interesting. It's interesting to watch the real you interact with the real someone else.
Yes.
That's interesting, you know? So our mission statement is truthful artistic play, because truth is a very important thing for us. I like to tell my students that for me that means that if you're an adult, that's no excuse not to play once in a while, you know, like you should play. Adulting doesn't mean not play. And also the truth is interesting, and the truth is funny, and the truth is dramatic, and the truth is all of those things, you know.
For me too, getting to know each other is a source of new information for for scenes. You're like, well, what am I going to talk about? Okay, well, let's talk about stuff. I'll be like, I'll do an introduction icebreaker. I was like, tell us your name, where you're from, why you took this class, and then what's the thing that you like super obsessed with right now? Like, is it a video game? Is it like a television show? Is it a book?
Cool,
are you
cool.
like
what's
making models of clay, whatever, when you're going home? Like, what do you do? What's your deal? And then we got 1,000 different things. And then, you know, we know that this guy's a DJ when he's at home. And, like, this person's obsessed with making artisanal soaps. So we can, like, then do scenes with these things that are like, I don't know anything about that, but I'm going to be all like, do I have enough material for the soap, dude? And then that guy can do a scene, and he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Like, just the idea of it's not scary. And, yes, most of our conversation, I feel like, has been, like, super deep. When it comes to like the improv stuff, but I feel like it's so palatable and it's so That's the thing. It's hard when you're talking about when can I get stage time? Yeah. When can I showcase my wonderful talents? Right. When can I do this thing? But when it's just like, let's have an experience, then it's easier.
Right.
And it's hard when it's interesting because the first stuff,
sorry, that was really interesting to me because the first part of it's like when can I rather than the second part you were like let's
that's something we're trying to stress really hard at Leela is a we mindset.
We've lost a lot of it in the world
for real though, right? Like we're insular, we're connected to these screens that are telling us that we're actually connected to other human beings. So the eye becomes the overwhelming sort of thing. Not the integrated eye, but like the eye that's disconnected from everyone else that is seeking to make us different than everyone else.
I talk a lot about like group presence, like as a like accountability rule for improv class, you know? So like similar to meditation, you have to be present with yourself and your own body. In improv, it's a group meditation. You know, you have to be present and accountable and receptive to the group, right? So I'll say, please balance your self-care needs with the needs of the group. You know, make your own choices. Like if you're sick, right, and you're contagious and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you need to stay home, you know? But also think about, like, if you see a burrito on the way to to class and you want to stop and get a burrito, is that more important than your group right now? Right?
Yeah. Wait. Yeah. Because it'll make them late or because they're going to be gassy?
Or they just decide. Okay.
Both.
No.
They walk in late, they're farting in every scene. Did you eat a burrito? What is happening?
Because that is a lot of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's like, oh, you know, oh, I see burrito. I'm hungry. Self-care.
Yeah.
I'm going to meet up with my friend that I committed to or my improv class.
For real.
Oh, yeah.
Just the idea of commitment in San Francisco is an abstract concept at best for most people.
No, that's a lot of and artistic improvisers as well. Sure. There's a big people are we'll talk about how it's hard to get people to commit to like coming to rehearsals.
Anything.
And like
showing
going up on time. To do showing up on time. Oh, lateness is our favorite thing. but it's you know it's I think it's different points of view, different efforts, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard because you almost want to give everybody like a personality test before you put them together in a troop. to be like, okay, these are the wild ones. We're going to make one troop with them and it'll probably fizzle in a week. These guys will be a troop for 27 years. They'll be like the crown jewel of San Francisco improv, you know? They've never stopped, you know, their grandparents, and they're all like, it's for you, Timmy, that's my grandson. She's been doing it his whole life, you know.
Oh, God, I hope
But I think it's the balance of all life. Like, there's people in your life that want to be committed and part
that's
of it,
true.
And then there's people that aren't, and the whole thing, like, I'm always trying to process everything as, like, I don't know, as the whole picture all the time. I have a hard time with small parts. I'm detail oriented in tiny bits, but they flitter away, but I can see the whole picture.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, it's going to be okay. And I also think earlier I made a theory. I posited that arts are going to be more important in the future.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why arts are going to be more important in the future is that as we go through political times that feel more and more tenuous, we need something to cling to, and that will be the arts.
There's a empirical evidence of that, right?
Like
the 60s turmoil art, you know, arguably in the 80s, the economy changed and money changed in a certain way. There was really interesting art happening in the 80s as well. More in Britain with like Thatcher and here with Reagan.
The crazier it gets in the world around you, the more likely you are to have to process it in an artistic way.
Yeah.
And I think that is actually in the same way that, you know, you put yourself out there to be a drama therapist and interesting that you bring mindfulness into your, you know, improv, how you put that together, that will help.
Yeah.
It's like we have these skills and we're just waiting until someone needs us to give it to help them. Right. You know what I mean? And I'm here to assure you that very soon people are going to need you more than you could possibly imagine. To the point where
I feel it now. I do feel it now. I feel like our students are on edge, like especially in San Francisco with like housing and economy stuff, and
even just a place where you can speak your mind and say what you need to say,
right?
Even if it's unusual, you know. Right. And I'm always like, it's okay for us to have different political views.
Yeah,
there have been, you know. Artists tend to be have a liberal bent, but there's a lot of different people in the world, and you know, I think improv is certainly message. A place to embrace everybody and say like, let's just work through stuff by playing stuff out. I mean, use drama to help us process it.
It's like the culture of San Francisco has become, I feel, less artistic over the past 10-15 years as gentrification happens and more tech. People come in, and no disparaging against tech people, but it is a different culture than the artistic community, right?
Yeah.
But that is a large part of our student base right now. And you can see that that those industries are they soak the messages of improv up so much, because the interpersonal stuff is stuff that if they're not interacting with each other in this way on the day to day,
and it's mind-blowing for them, because it's almost like a lot of these folks you know, are people that have studied math and science and excelled at it their whole life, and then they're like, they feel this need to exercise the other part of their brain, and they're like, you know, like, this is different. I never thought of things in this way.
Well, the idea of abundant acceptance over like, oh wait, like because capitalism, we have to be critical because of capitalism. You have to have the best product, the best, the most work output, all that stuff, and then to get the message of like, sure, okay, the inner critic serves a purpose, but like also can be detrimental to the artistic process.
Yeah.
What do? We shut down ideas when we're criticizing and prejudging ideas all the time, right? Like, what if there's just abundant yes with your team, like, and you're building on each other's ideas? Oh, right, there would be possibly more people would feel comfortable sharing their ideas. Yeah. If more people are comfortable sharing their ideas, then you have a better chance of innovative ideas happening. Yeah. You have to speak in the speak of capitalism, right? Yeah. Innovation happens.
I teach corporate workshops.
Yes.
But also the inherent idea around capitalism is that one idea is the best idea. And in improv, what we learn is that there are actually many best ideas. Like, there are many best ideas. Right. So we get to just select one of those and choose that one and select the next one down.
Yeah.
I think that's revelatory for people in those industries.
Yeah.
My eyes finally clearing up. That, you can edit that.
I think it's revelatory about, you know, everyone to even allow a multiple path.
Yeah. Right.
To say it isn't just this way is the right way, and that's it. Right.
Well, it's empathy. It's empathy that we're teaching, too.
Yeah.
Because if somebody makes a choice and we have to say yes to it, we have to live in that person's experience. We have to live in that. We have to walk that experience alongside of them.
Yeah.
It's we're empathy. We're empathizing. It's like we're in it with them, you know?
Earlier we were talking about students, how they get bogged down with rules and stuff like that. And I feel like you have to learn all the rules, then break all the rules before you can get to the empathy.
Yeah.
It's almost like people who do those acting exercises that kind of break you down.
Yeah.
The ones where, you know, they just tear away at the person, the and then all of a sudden it's like, this is what is going on in this scenario.
Right.
Empathy is the end result once you've gone through enough that you can feel comfortable, because in the same way that you were just talking about, in our minds, especially from birth, we are told, like, there's one path for you and your path is X. And you're like, okay, great. But in my cycle theory, we get to a point where we're like, that path doesn't work for me anymore.
Right.
I'm going to find a different one. Mm-hmm. Do I happen to be at a crossroads? Oops, turns out I am. Let me turn this way and go that different direction.
Yeah.
And now, even earlier, we were talking about travel. We're doing it physically.
Yeah.
We are finding a way to be like, I'm going to end this journey, part of my journey, and move to the next one. But, you know, if we're not cognizant of the decisions we're making, we'll never be able to get to the empathy part. Like, if we're not like, it's okay, you know, you can't just learn, oh yeah, I can do different paths. It's like, okay, but remember the last time when you had a hard time doing this, do you now have empathy for those people? Because like, just different parts of my life where I'm like, I've been there. This has happened to me too. Yeah.
You have to suffer to learn in a way. Well, what's the Rumi quote? The light enters. My pretentious moment is gone. it's something about the wound is where the light comes in, right? Like, you have to be able to do that to practice the empathy sort of muscle. Mm-hmm. You have to have been.
Well, they talk about privilege too. Like, there's this beautiful quote about privilege, which is privilege is, I can't remember it. Believing something isn't true because it isn't true for you personally.
Oh, yeah.
Oof. That's the definition of privilege.
What?
Believing something isn't true because it isn't true for you personally.
Yep. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It's a very interesting thing, especially sort of jumping into that idea, and we'll wrap up with this little rumination we'll have here of about the idea that, like, we are in a time when we're trying to examine being able to see other people's points of views and to be able to step in their shoes for a moment and understand. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we need to do that in every way.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, I'm a very negative person when it comes to politics and stuff. I'm all like, yeah, where's the money? That's where they're making the decision. But there's a lot of...
That's not negative. That's the truth. Yeah.
But I try myself to say... I always go, okay, but what's in it for them? Because I try to see it from people's point of view. I'm like, great, we're going to make this situation go on. Why would it happen? Like, okay, I understand. Like, evil decisions, cool, but who's it benefit?
Yeah.
I go, this terrible thing is continuing to go on. I don't understand why it's continuing to go on. Wait, who is it benefiting?
Yeah.
Like, and I have to figure those things out because, you know, we can try to just be empathetic of people we care about or people who we initially identify with or people who we feel bad have been marginalized.
Right.
But we can also have to empathize with these people who we don't understand even remotely where they could be coming from.
That's the real work.
That is the real work.
It's not empathy if you're selecting just the people that you've already decided are your people or whatever.
You have to
empathize with those that have harmed you specifically. Right? Mm-hmm. If you're able to do that, if you're able to say, why is this person irritating me personally, then you can discover that they're actually your greatest teacher.
Yeah.
Because typically for me, someone that is irritating me, someone that I'm having beef with or I'm just struggling against for some reason, when I'm able to get to that place, I'm able to realize that what is bugging me about them is some manifestation of myself that I don't like very much.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, that...
Disowned part.
Yeah. This thing that, you know, I'm not that type of person.
Right.
Why am I saying that? Because I am. We're all many things at once, right? And that's a thing that I've sought to improve myself. So now I'm judgmental that someone is actually living in this thing that I actually can empathize with because I have lived in that thing.
Right.
So that makes me a hypocrite, right? So it's like you have to learn. In that way, they can be your teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did this like corporate gig. And I had the opportunity to work with an organizational change management consultant. This was like a cool
title.
And they wanted me to talk with her in preparation for the team building I was going to lead with them because this company was going through some massive structural changes. And she was kind of leading the process through this whole organizational change they were going through, right?
Yeah.
And so I had multiple phone calls with her and I was like, this is really fun. I was like, maybe I'll be an organizational change management. Like, it's super fascinating. And she had some slides she was having me look over that she was going to present to the group before the team building. And there was this acronym and it was like WIFM. And I was like, what does this acronym mean? And she's like, what's in it for me? And I was like, and it was like in process of like, you know, helping the employees understand what this change would do for them, you know, the positive of it, right? And I was like, wow. You know, it was just like got me into that corporate mindset of like, yeah, that's where everybody's coming from. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? What's in it for me? And I was like, what about what's in it for we?
And I just like offered that up to her. I was like, I'm going to be doing this team building that has everything to do with us coming together as a group and coming towards a common goal and figuring out the process through a common goal approach. Like, can we change that acronym? You know? Yeah. She's like, wow. You know, like, but that was like a cool, like, yeah, this is the method or this is the mindset of like a lot of corporations and what they're going through, you know?
I think it's in the mind of a lot of people just in general. What's in it for me?
Yeah.
I feel like that, like you said, saying that is like epiphany of other things we've talked about just even today.
Yeah.
Like, why are people bitching about how much things cost? What's in it for me?
Right.
Why are people trying to go and be competitive about these things when really they could just, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
We're all trying to find some sort of, even the self-care stuff, what's in it for me?
Right.
Like, so interesting. It's how we're all framed, and the we part is exactly how we try to bring it. In the improv world, to try to make people a little bit better.
Yeah.
Cool.
Absolutely.
This is great.
This is so good.
Good conversation, guys. Yay. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I feel like this is just some good talk for people to, like, I don't know, figure your life out, guys.
Together.
Send me messages, guys, when you're listening. If you need help, I'll help you.
Absolutely.
Goodness, figure your life out. Yay. Good. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. It was our pleasure. Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.